This podcast contains subject matter of a graphic nature. The stories, for some, are the worst days of their lives. The content is for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome to This Could Be My Last Podcast. I'm your host, Brenda. Today, I'm joined by the award-winning author of Freedom's Child, who just released her first true crime book titled Hell in the Heartland, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls, Jax Miller. Hi, Jax.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on here.
Thank you for joining me today on my little podcast. I love it. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
We're just going to go ahead and jump right in. With so many moving pieces, there's a lot to cover. So for the listeners at home who may not know the story, why don't you start on the night of December 30th, 1999? What happened in the small town in Oklahoma?
So it was actually the early morning of December 30th when neighbors found a trailer in flames. Now, this is a region in northeastern Oklahoma. They call it Green Country. It's very rural. It's out there in the prairie. And this trailer, you know, it was far from civilization, far from any close neighbors. And these neighbors found the trailer on fire. They called the police, or they had neighbors call the police. The sheriff's office came, and they found one body, that of 38-year-old Kathy Freeman. It was initially assumed that her husband, Danny Freeman, had killed her before abducting their 16-year-old daughter, who was also in the house that night, and the daughter's best friend, 16-year-old Laura Bible. So for the first 24 hours, that's what everyone believed. Danny went off the deep end, killed his wife, and took the two girls. There were some tips called into the sheriff's office. The primary lead that they had was a tip that came in saying, you know, Danny has the girls, he's holding them hostage, and he's not going to give them back until you give up the cop who shot his son. Less than a year before, Kathy and Danny's 17-year-old son, Shane Freeman, had been killed by a sheriff's deputy just about 10 miles west of there. So that was the big thing. Danny kills his wife, takes the girls, and goes on the run. So Laura Bible, their friend who was sleeping over, her family, they're hysterical. I mean, they want to know what happened. And they go to the crime scene, and then 24 hours after Kathy's body was found, they stumble upon a second body, and it's that of the prime suspect, Danny Freeman. So we have two dead parents, and the girls have been missing ever since.
When did you become involved in the story? You knew about the story prior to your involvement with the book. When did you stumble upon this?
You know, I don't remember from where I first heard it, and that's everyone's first question. I wish I had a better answer. I don't remember, but it always stuck with me. I always remembered those girls. And I didn't know the details. I didn't know their names, but I went online. It was like 2015 or something like that. And I looked them up, and it was something like best friends, fire, trailer. You know, I put some basic words in a Google search, and lo and behold, they were, and this is 15 years later after the fact. And lo and behold, they were in the news that week. They were actually looking in the well, on the property of a convicted murderer, looking for the remains of the girls. And I said, oh my God, this case is still going on, and it's still active. And that's because of Laureen Bible, the mother of Laura Bible. The woman largely in charge, I say, she's the investigator. She's every agency put together. And she has stopped at nothing to find her daughter. She said, wow, I think I want to do this story. I want to write their story, because I thought this woman was so amazing. I thought she was so incredible. And I guess I was just really impressed by Laureen Bible, how she hadn't succumbed to alcoholism or despair. She kept going. She stayed strong. And I was very impressed by that.
She is a very impressive human. I mean, she's just incredible, because on top of her doing all of this work, she's still missing her daughter.
And I've said that to her. I'm like, you know, I don't think I could do what you do. I mean, if that was me, if that was my daughter, I says, I couldn't do it. And she says, well, you don't know how strong you are until you have to be. That's what she tells me. I know that she'll often cite John Walsh. Of course, you know John Walsh. And at the time, he was with America's Most Wanted, and he spoke with Laureen. And of course, you know, he lost his own son, who had also gone missing. And he gave her the advice, you know, right now you have to make a choice. Like right now is so important. Make a choice. You can either hide in the closet and everyone's going to forget Laura's name in a month or so, or you can be that child's voice. She decided right then, I'm going to be Laura's voice. I'm going to be the one fighting for her. I'm not going to let this, you know, die down. I know Callahan Walsh, who was John Walsh's son, recently wrote her and says, you know, Laura is a song. It's your job to keep singing. And I thought that was so powerful. Like, you know, she just keeps singing Laura's song.
Oh, my God. I literally started to well up.
You should read the letter in its entirety. It's beautiful.
Let's talk about John Walsh, Lorraine Bible. Their stories kind of crisscross because there was some mishandling of the case from the get-go. So start with, there was this pending, what was it? It was a civil case, correct?
So you have two theories that stand a foot above the rest. One of the theories is that this was something that involved police, and this stems from the death of 17-year-old Shane Freeman, who I actually felt incredibly close to when writing the book, even more so than the girls. I did feel a strong connection when writing about Shane, and I think Shane was a troubled kid. I don't think his home life was easy, to say the least, but I think he was a good kid, and he was just that. He was a kid. We can never know exactly what happened. I talk in the book about what we know about Shane. I know that I think I got the first public interview with the shooting officer who shot and killed Shane, but what happened was he went on this little petty crime spree where he was lifting cars, impersonating officers, nothing violent, just rebellious. You know, he was a bit of a rebel without a cause, if you will. One of the stolen trucks he had lifted broke down on the side of the road. Officer David Hay showed up, and within seconds, David Hay shot and killed Shane. Kathy and Danny did not accept that this was a justifiable shooting. Again, this is something I get into in the book because there's a lot of details to it. But based on reports changing based on this, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think that they had good reason. I don't think that this was just a family reacting out of grief. I think that this warranted an investigation. They were in the process of filing a wrongful death suit. They had seen several lawyers, but every lawyer kept on telling them, you don't have a case, you don't have a case. In the year between Shane's death, which was January 8th, 1999, and the fire, which was December 30th, 1999, there was a lot of harassment going back and forth between Danny and the sheriff's office. And I think it was just one bad egg, if you really want to know the truth. And I think a lot of the other officers may have turned a blind eye. But it was a lot of harassment going back and forth. Danny Freeman was unlawfully arrested. The cops were shining spotlights on the trailer in the middle of the night. They would follow them home. There was a lot of harassment on behalf of the sheriff's office and from Danny, too. But I think, you know, in the sheriff's office, you have to be held at a higher standard, of course. So they had 1 year to file suit. So they only had like a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks left, not even 2 weeks left to file. And right before that window closed, well, the murders happened. A lot of mishandling. You start with Jay and Lorraine Bible finding the body of Danny Freeman. Then the girls aren't entered into the NCIC. Evidence is not taken into consideration. And the families begin doing the investigating themselves. In fact, those next 3 days, the agents stood on the sidelines while family members put down evidence markers at what they deemed evidence at the crime scene. Now, it also bears noting that as soon as the sheriff's office showed up to the fire, they did put their hands up and say, listen, we got bad blood with this family. We're going to pass it over to the OSBI, which is the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. So that's worth noting, too. And from there, it was led by Agent Steve Nutter, and he's the one who really, you know, missed a lot of steps.
A lot of steps. Because immediately there was evidence found by family members that pertained to what eventually led to an arrest later on.
Right. And, you know, that's the heartbreaking thing is in 2018, we're learning of all this stuff. When the affidavit was released and we're all sitting there reading it, it's like, holy shit. One thing after another, and like had they followed this, had they followed that, had they followed this or that or this or that, you know, we would have found those girls. They would have found those girls alive, most likely. And that's such a heartbreaking aspect of this story. And it's not lost on anyone.
And definitely want to encourage my listeners to read Hell in the Heartland, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls, because it does go into much more detail about the missteps that were taken, but it's not just the missteps. There were 12 people who physically saw these women alive still, and that could have intervened and said something to bring them home.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't think we've seen the end of this. I really don't. I think there's more to be discovered. perhaps more arrests to be made.
And there should be. There should be some answering for this, for sure. I know that we can't make law enforcement answer for their stumbling in the beginning. I understand that, but it's frustrating. That part of it's so frustrating for me, especially after hearing one of the officers stood on the body of Danny.
Yes, that's largely believed to be Steve Nutter, the OSBI agent. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the girls, because you really bring them to life for me in a way that I wasn't expecting. I expected to learn more about the crime itself, but you brought home Ashley and Laura to me. You made it feel like I knew them.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because that was something I tried to make a point out of, was, you know, being very victim centric. I didn't want to focus too much on the killers. I didn't want to focus too much on the macabre, which I could have, but I don't err on the side of sensationalism. I'm a writer. I'm not a very investigative person. Well, I guess until this, I really wanted to paint them not as victims of these horrible crimes, but as these wholesome, sweet 16-year-old girls that they were. I wanted people to be like, holy crap, that could have been my sister or my friend or my daughter. So that's why I'm really happy that's what you took from it, because that's what I was going for. And of course, I do focus on the killers and the crimes.
Yeah, you did bring to light some of the suspects. I mean, the suspects went from Tommy Lee Sells to Jeremy Jones, which I call the Wish version of Ted Bundy. Because he's just a knockoff version, a wannabe, to me, is what it feels like.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's a guy who knows what he wants and he knows what to say to get it.
That I do agree with. But the last three suspects that we did get a lot of attention on was Ronnie Busick, Philip Welsh II, David Pennington. These are the last suspects. And again, I'm going to encourage everybody to read the book. There's more details also online, because currently he pled, right?
He did. Accessory to murder.
Yes. And there's a lot of reasons and moving pieces behind the scene, and everybody was quiet about it prior to the release of it. And it looked on paper, it looks awful, because it looks like he got away with something, when in actuality, no, there's more things happening behind the scenes that are important we need to focus on.
And I'm happy that you acknowledge it, because when everybody heard that he was about to get 5 years in jail, or, you know, 8 years, time served, whatnot, everyone was losing their minds. Like, oh my God, that's not enough. That's not everyone. And, you know, the Bibles, the Freemans, they had known about this deal long before it was made public, of course. And I know it does sound short. And of course, yes, we would all like to see him, you know, spend the rest of his life in jail. And 5 years, in all reality, is probably the rest of his life. But yeah, like, they had to work with what they had. You have to look at the evidence they had. Had this thing gone to trial, I think he could have walked. And I think a lot of people knew that. There was not a lot of hard evidence against him, no physical evidence. It was really thin. He did plead accessory to murder, but I do think that was the best deal that they could have gotten with what they had. And Phil Welch was obviously the ringleader in this, and, you know, out of those three amigos, Busick was largely the tag along. You know, he did what he was told, and that was the case for most people who hung out with Phil Welch. He was, you know, larger in charge. You did what you were told around him. And yeah, we are dealing with the low income families. The Freemans were also low income. You know, it is a poorer place. And then on the other side, you also have a beautiful part of Oklahoma and a beautiful part of the region with the ranchers and the prairies, and quite beautiful. And I've gotten a lot of letters, like people have said, wow, you know, you made this place so beautiful sounding. And then other people were like, you made this beautiful place sound god awful. It's like, I think it depends on, you know, how you read it. These men were from Chautauqua, Kansas, for the most part. And then they relocated to Pitcher, which is now known as the most toxic place in America. We're dealing with sinkholes and too much undermining, you know, collapsed buildings, poisonous waters, sickness, and, you know, lead mining. I don't know if I mentioned that. It was once known as the buckle of America's lead belt. And it's a fascinating place. In fact, when I wrote the book, I wrote like a 60-page chapter on this town, Pitcher, alone. But they're like, no, take it out, you know, editors. You take this poverty, and I think with the collapsing of the lead and zinc mines, I think that created a wave of despair, depression, and people looked to drugs as their new crutch. You had people who were now largely unemployed. Many of them were relocated because of the government taking over the town and creating a Superfund site. And I think it made it easy for people to become addicted.
It was. And I want to touch on that part that's increasing because currently in the middle of a pandemic, we're having to stay home. Drug overdoses are increasing. Suicides are increasing. But at the same time, in your book, you make sure the reader knows that this place isn't all evil. It's a beautiful place to raise your children. It's just this underseed of this addiction, this epidemic that's happening with overdoses and needing to replace that need, that hurt in someone with methamphetamines or whatever is the choice at the time. You did a really good job with that and bringing that home.
But I think that's everywhere you go. I mean, you can go to the most beautiful places in the world and it's going to have, you know, that underbelly. I've been to really dark places where I've seen so much love and light. It's amazing. So I think it's all about perspective. And yes, I'm dealing with murder. I'm dealing with drugs. I'm dealing with this dark side, which I knew I would be. I it wasn't like, oh, where'd this come from? I knew what I was getting into in a way when I started this story. But I think it's outshined by people like Laureen Bible and the Bibles and the Freemans and the people who are still carrying on the girls' names and the people who collect during milestones and have birthday cakes for Laura and Ashley and things like this. You know, that's what I'm a big believer. Light always wins. Light wins. And I think goodness wins. And I think that that's very evident in this story. Yeah, we have some badass people. We have some dark people. But you know what? Love wins.
It's amazing to me how touching their story of bringing their daughters to life in front of us really impacts everybody. Because I see it through their Facebook. The Facebook was open for investigating. I know that, to make connections, but it's also for people to reach out to them and just want them to know, hey, I live in California. I want you to know I'm thinking of the girls. It's amazing community that brings that together.
Yeah. And again, I think the Facebook page is spectacular because what they're doing is they're making the girls real. Now they're not just a name in print in a newspaper. Here's her 10th birthday. Here's her last Christmas. You know, here are very real things. Here's her and her high school crush, you know, and that's all stuff that we can relate to. And that's so important. And that's also what I try to do with Hell in the Heartland was just make them relatable so that when tragedy strikes, you feel it. And of course it's going to be very, very, very minuscule when compared to the real life families, but that Facebook page has opened so many doors, not just for the investigative stuff, but just showing the world how great Laura and Ashley were. And I think it's phenomenal, and I've always been very impressed with how they've been able to keep themselves composed and how they display themselves and the missing girls.
That's amazing. I want to encourage my listeners to read this book. It's an amazing book. Jax does a great, great job of bringing the story to home to you, where you feel like you're part of the family. Jax, what's next for you? What's on the books, as some would say, for you next? I know that you're taking it easy and we're quarantining right now, but what's on the agenda?
Well, I'm not taking it easy, see, because being a writer, you know, this quarantine hasn't hit me very hard. I work from home anyway as a writer. So I've been very busy. But I'm not allowed to say with what yet.
That's amazing.
I will be returning to the true crime genre, though. And that was something I was debating because I wasn't sure if I was going to.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. It's important. I always ask those who are on my podcast, how do you handle such a heavy subject all the time, or your grief? Because you feel part of the family now. So how are you handling things right now with things have kind of quieted down because we have a suspect that is arrested. He is in prison. We have not brought the girls home, so we're still focused on that.
You know, that's something I talked a lot about in Hell in the Heartland. As somebody who struggles with mental health issues, it's in my family. It's something I'm very open about. And that really came to a head during this case, because when I came to it, we had no suspects. And I found myself, you know, am I sitting with the killer? Is this the killer? Is that the killer? Are the girls here? Are they there? And I kind of, you know, I had to learn over the years how to handle it, because I think it hit me very hard at first. And I learned from people like Laureen Bible and Lisa Broderick Bible, you know, or Bible Broderick, their composure and their restraint. And that taught me so much. I think you can keep a distance, and a lot of people do keep a distance. You know, people can write or do a podcast or do a show about a true crime, and it's like a 9-to-5 thing. They're done with it when they go home and they enjoy their families. For me, writing is what I eat, breathe, and sleep. So this was my life for 5 years. I don't think a lot of people realize that. And I think I always knew closure would be a struggle. I knew there was no closure in this case. For me, I was in Oklahoma this summer with the families, and I went to court. I looked at Ronnie Busick for the first time in the eyes when he got sentenced. It's crazy because I thought I would feel so much, and I didn't. I actually felt nothing. And that surprised me. That really surprised me. I thought I'd feel something, and I didn't. And again, I think this is where love wins again, because I didn't care to look at him. I didn't feel anything. And then Lorene's up there saying, "I forgive you," to him. And again, it was just like she took the air out of the room in the best way possible. I mean, that light just shone from her. I wish that they had closure. I wish I could help them get that closure. I'm always going to support them. You know, I didn't just drop the story because the book, you know, ended. Like I said, I was just at court this summer. I was just talking to Lisa 10 minutes before I started with you, just chatting and shooting the bullshit.
She seems like such a fun person.
She is.
She's a total mom. Like, that part of it, I would not be able to relate as much, but the rest of it, she seems like such a kick. I would love to know her.
Yeah, she's amazing. In fact, because I was going to go there this Christmas, but now I may not be able to. We're trying to work plans out. But, you know, right now, Lorene Bible is sick. And this is another struggle she's been, you know, hiding for some time. We've known about it for years, but she didn't want to say it. She's not well right now. So we're all hoping that there are answers, you know, while she's still with us. And hopefully she's with us a little longer. But, you know, she is very sick. I just support her the best I can from here. But I pray every day that she gets the answers, because she, you know, she needs them. And she's worked so hard for them. My God.
I didn't know. I'm so sorry. That must be very hard, because you've become a part of the family.
It breaks my heart. It really breaks my heart. She needs a liver transplant. She's in the last stages of liver failure. So I mean, it's heartbreaking, because I mean, it's like, you think about it, this woman's been through so much, and yet she's the strongest woman I've ever met. And, you know, it's like, I'll talk to her. How do you do this? How do you do this? And she's like, you know, what choice do I have? I just keep going. And that's her attitude. She just keeps going. And again, I just think she's the most admirable woman I've ever met.
I met you on stage. Well, not technically meeting you. I didn't meet till after. But you were on stage, and the family stood up, and she mentioned at that point, this isn't just a story to us. Please keep that in mind, because it kind of comes off that we're peeking into someone's horrible day, and we are for entertainment. And I really wanted to hug her at that moment and say, that's not why I'm here. And I know that the women that were sitting next to me, we're not there for entertainment. We're there to know your daughter, to know her and I wanted her to know that. But it's one of those things where you say the wrong thing and it's like, she'll remember that part. And I don't want that. So we just, you know, be quiet. but I got to meet you from it. And, but I want her to know, because of her work, because of that, you were able to find her, and I am able to know who her daughter is. And that sticks with me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And you know what? She's so forgiving, because there's been so many times I put my foot in my mouth, and, you know, she and I have yelled at, like, we yell at each other. We're a little bit like a real family. Like, we argue and stuff, but, you know, at the end of the day, she is so thankful. I know she's so thankful for everyone, for their prayers, for their thoughts, for spreading the word. I know how much that means to her. Cause I know she's worked so hard to keep the girls' names alive. And like I said, you know, when Callahan Walsh said, "Laura's a song, it's your job to keep singing it." You know, I think it means so much to have a whole chorus behind her. People like you, people who share the story, the publishers, people with TV and stuff. It's so important that Laura's song keeps getting sung.
Well, let's close out the show and let's talk about Ashley and Laura. Tell me your favorite story of those two girls, because they sound like they were just so much fun.
Favorite ones came from, I think it's out there, whether it's in the book or whatever, is the Rambo story. And when Laura was in kindergarten, Sheena was sitting in front of Laura. She sat in front of her in kindergarten class one day, and Laura was in this like yellow windbreaker matching suit, like with this headband, like the sweatband around her head, like Rambo, you know, early 90s, maybe even late 80s. And Sheena's like, what the hell is this girl looking like Rambo? And Laura, never, you know, knowing Sheena, she wraps her leg or her feet around like the legs of the desk with the ankle. And she just pulls her head back and she just flashes her jacket and shirt up and shows her bare chest to Sheena. It's just like out of nowhere. Laura was just so full of spunk and life and hilarious. And Lorene's like that too, because even though we see her as the mother of a missing child, she is largely a jokester. You know, she plays jokes on me all the time and pranks. She's such a pain in the ass. I love her. Yeah, I mean, that's the stuff. That's the meat of Hell in the Heartland. It's just getting to know these girls, knowing these beautiful stories.
A heartfelt thank you goes out to Jax Miller for joining me today and telling me more stories about the girls. Jax has made a small request from me, the host, and you, the listener, to please like and share Find Laura Bible Facebook page on Facebook. You may know someone in your feed who has the tip that will bring the girls home. So like and share, and let's bring these girls home. A small request from me, please support your local independent bookstore by purchasing Jax Miller's new book, Hell in the Heartland, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls. I want to thank you for listening today. Music by Elaine Douglas. Artwork by Sarah Stroud. All research conducted by Brenda Cheslock. Look for me on social media and click and subscribe wherever podcasts are sold, or this could be my last podcast.